ballots. However, in that arena, the Anderson campaign came out the winner.
I had an interesting experience as I came in here a short time ago from the airport, from O'Hare. I engaged in conversation, as I sometimes do, with the cab driver. In this particular case, it was a good thing, I guess, that I did that and established who he was before I told him where I was going, because he turned out to be Eugene Phillips, who achieved a certain fleeting fame a few weeks ago in his contact with a member of the television industry. So I chose not to tell him that I was appearing before some of the stars and performers in that industry at noon today. Well, I suppose that it is customary, of course, to express pleasure at appearing before a particular audience to establish the proper rapport. I guess if I were totally honest, I would have to tell you that I would rather be elsewhere. I would rather be huddled with my advisors in Blair House interviewing prospective nominees to the cabinet. I would rather perhaps be ensconced in the Situation Room in the White House looking over contingency plans for the crisis in Poland. But that was not to be, and since I have a few days before I start filming my American Express card commercials, Bruce was generous enough to suggest that I come and share a few thoughts with you about how well you did or did not perform in the recent election. You know, none other than the President of the United States, when the debate about the debate was taking place just 3 months ago in early September, the President of the United States himself suggested that it was the media that had created the Anderson campaign. Well, now, that statement obviously has, as most statements do, both some elements of truth and, I think, of untruth. It is true, of course, that Americans get all of their news by way of the media. This is not China, where up until at least recently, people got it from wall posters. We don't live in this country on a desert island where the news comes washed up on some sun-kissed shore in the form of a note tucked into a bottle. No, to the extent that any prominent personality, if I can describe myself as such, to the extent that he or she exists in the minds of the public, be it John Anderson or Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan, it is because the press has chosen to report about him. And if the plug were pulled tomorrow on all television cameras, and if the printing presses around the nation suddenly ground to a halt, I doubt that there would be that much word-of-mouth communication that would really serve to enlighten the American people about any of us, and more particularly about our views. I thought it was a little bit ungracious, frankly, of Jimmy Carter to make the charge that he did, that I was simply the figment of the media, because my memory is not so short that I do not recall that it was basically the media that propelled him out of that very large pack of about a dozen or more Democratic candidates in 1976, when with only 30% of the vote cast in the Iowa caucuses in January of 1976, it was nevertheless enough to propel him into the forefront as a candidate. No, I don't think the press can really create a candidate. I don't give you credit for having that power, because it seems to me you can give a candidate publicity, but if there is nothing really to the candidacy, it's going to fade. We have in this recent election, I think, the celebrated case of the man who spent, what was it, $11, $12, $13 million and ended up with a single delegate. It wasn't for want of publicity. But I think the more publicity that John Connally received, the more doubts arose in the minds of the American people about the wheeler-dealer image that fairly or unfairly had attached to him over the years that he had been on the public scene. Well, I don't challenge the right of the press to report what they think the news is. But that, of course, as the great Shakespeare said, that is the question. What the news is. I know the press from the contacts that I have had with them now, particularly over the last 18 months, and indeed going back of that for the 20 years that I have been in public life, are always very sensitive to the charge that they are arbitrary in their coverage. And I think most of them try to establish in their mind some objective basis in order to determine how they cover a campaign and who they should cover. But we are faced, regrettably, with a kind of catch-22 situation, at least talking now about the presidential nominating process. What it boils down to is that you've got to be famous to be covered, but you never really become famous unless you are covered. And how do you become famous? Well, it was pointed out in a very interesting book that I have been reading lately, and some of you perhaps have seen as well, Tom Patterson, who wrote The Mass Media Election, How Americans Choose Their President, pointed out, and I haven't seen this table produced yet for the 1980 election, but somehow I have the feeling that the figures that he quotes that he has summarized for the 1976 election will turn out to be not too far off the mark as far as 1980 is concerned. But it's a very interesting table that shows the weekly news coverage in terms of a candidate's percentage of total news coverage of the campaign, what it was, and it is clearly linked to the order in which they finished in the particular week's primary that was going on at that period of time. Specifically, he points out that the candidate who finished in first place got 59% or almost three-fifths of the network news coverage of the campaign. He picked a newspaper, I don't know why, it was the Erie Times. That was pretty close, to show that there isn't that much difference maybe between the print media and the electronic media. That was 58%. The LA Times was 60%, to pick another newspaper. Time Magazine was a little bit more generous in their coverage of the front runner. They gave him 62% of the total coverage of the campaign for that particular week. The second place, and this is what is really dramatic about this summary, the second place candidate fell to 17% of total coverage. As far as network news, 18% and 19% as far as the two papers respectively that I mentioned, 14% in Time Magazine. You get down to fourth place, that fellow's probably out of the running as far as coverage. 8% on network evening news, 8% and 6% in the two newspapers, and 11%, for some reason, a little bit higher in Time Magazine. But what do the candidates do? And who knows better than one who has gone through that process? Well, as I look at the last campaign, which is the one, obviously, with which I'm most familiar, what they tried to do, what George Bush, let's take a specific example, tried to do, as you well know, was to follow the example of Jimmy Carter, to organize early, to organize in a very elaborate way, because if that early win was achieved, if the first rung on the ladder was attained, then you would immediately get that 58% coverage of network news, and the other media would pretty much follow in line. I think there's a legitimate question as to whether or not that is the basis on which the media ought to decide who it is they cover, because there is a very real sense in which the candidate, the presidential candidate, is then really using the press. They become the tool of the particular strategy that he has elected to employ. Now, I'm not going to get out the crying towel and use my 10 or 15 minutes with you this afternoon to cite you chapter and verse some of my impressions of where the media went wrong. But I can assure you that anything that sounds like criticism is spoken recognition of the fact that this is the season of peace on earth, goodwill toward men. And so it is in the spirit of the love and the peace of the Advent season that I presume to take on the media and to give you some examples of where I would be less than candid if I didn't confess some unhappiness. Until the Massachusetts primary, there was the one event, and Bruce was good enough to mention it in his introduction. We did have that little, I think, blip on the political radar screen that came about because of the Iowa debates. But that, I had a feeling, was somewhat ephemeral. And so it was really not until the near win on the 4th of March in Massachusetts and in Vermont. We were defeated, as you know, by Reagan by about 800 votes only in Vermont. We were within 1,000 votes of George Bush, who claimed Massachusetts as one of his numerous home states. But that was enough to really give us some headlines in some fairly big papers across the country, as well as to attract a considerable amount of television coverage, electronic coverage as well. But until that breakthrough, the biggest chunks of national publicity that I got, it seemed to me, and I could give you three examples, was on one occasion the little headquarters, rather seedy, run-down place that we were renting in Southeast Washington. It was robbed of a couple of electrical appliances. We put out a very tongue-in-cheek press release dismissing it all very magnanimously as merely a third-rate burglary. That was the kind of cutesy story that every newscast was bound to end with for a night or two after that event took place. When I made the comment after Iowa to a reporter that I had gotten over 1% in the national polls for the first time, that I was making progress, I was no longer an asterisk. That somehow was sufficiently pungent as a phrase or an expression to get a little attention. I remember John Chancellor asking me in an interview on the night of the New Hampshire primary whether I was going to stay in the race. That was just a week before Massachusetts. And I said, well, as long as I have clean laundry. Well, that was the kind of story, you know, that seemed to go out across the wires. And actually, at a fundraising reception a couple of weeks later in Washington, I got a huge package with some very colorful shorts. So I suppose I should be grateful. But the question, the real question is, did we say anything that was really meaningful before that time? Well, the gas tax, which got to be kind of a hallmark of the campaign because it tied into the energy issue, which I still think was one of the important issues of the campaign, that was proposed in July of 1979, just about a month or so after I had made my formal announcement as a candidate. I then put it into legislation with all of the details. And with my apologies to my friend from Time magazine, I recall rather vividly that about a week after that occurred, after the legislation was put in, that there was a very lengthy story as to what the candidates were saying about energy, and the conclusion was that they weren't saying much of anything, and that they were all saying about the same thing, which was nothing. Well, I believe the reason they reached that conclusion was simply that at that time they were talking about Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, Teddy Kennedy, Jerry Brown, John Connolly, Howard Baker, and George Bush, There wasn't enough, really, they thought, about this candidacy to really make it viable, and therefore our views were not that significant. I think of one other example, the issue of the Cambodian famine. And I cite this more as a specific example of how I think the media tended to differentiate in the coverage that it gave different candidates on the same issue. Steve Solars, a young congressman from New York, and I were the first two members of the Congress to actually introduce and to testify before the House Foreign Affairs Committee on a $30 million emergency relief bill for Cambodian famine relief. And I know my press secretary called about 50 reporters to let them know that on a certain day I was going to testify before the subcommittee on this bill and give what I thought was one of my most impassioned pleas in favor of Cambodian famine relief. And the reaction from most of the people that were called was, oh yeah, Anderson, he's running for president. Well, he doesn't have a chance, but, you know, if we can show up, we will, but needless to say, nobody did. Well, about 3 weeks later, as I recall it, Teddy Kennedy took up the issue of Cambodia. It had ripened to the point where apparently he thought it was worth dealing with, and immediately it was literally propelled into the headlines. That motivated the counterpoint by Jimmy Carter, and soon it was the biggest news of the day. But this was a lesson that I felt occurred more than once during the campaign, that it was not always what you said that made the news. To some extent, it was who. Now, I don't blame the press entirely for the fact that they don't consider issues in the abstract, that they do tend to associate them with people, because if an issue is going to go someplace, it has to have powerful support, and the personality of the person who takes up an issue is not entirely extraneous, I think, to the question that we're talking about. But I guess to sum it up, I had a feeling that we could do a much better job in the media in this country if we did not place quite the emphasis on who said what and paid more attention to what was said. Because it really leads the candidates themselves down the wrong road. They succumb, and I did it myself, to the irresistible temptation to think that what you have to do to get recognition is to say something in a nice, neat, colorful little snippet or phrase that is going to be repeated, that's going to fit into that 20 seconds or so that is available on the network that evening. You have to say something also you get to feel after a while that is different, that is timely. But at the same time, you have to avoid saying something so controversial or off the cuff that it might invite undue scrutiny and shift the focus from the issue itself to the issue of whether the candidate has made a gap. And I think there is too much. I don't suppose Ronald Reagan needs any defense from me. He won the election. But I believe to an unwarranted extent, there was this fascination and preoccupation with the gap. And as a result, it has a kind of chilling effect whereby the candidate is discouraged from speaking as candidly as he should. It encourages the kind of packaging, the kind of orchestrating, the kind of staging, which you don't like. And you recognize, I think, on many occasions that you are really being taken by the candidate who indulges in that kind of tactic. In the book that I referred to by Patterson, he makes the very interesting observation and in a way sets up the problem, and it's easier to state the problem than it is, I guess, to recommend the solution. But he says, for example, that the press clearly has a bias for clear-cut issues. Issues, you know, that can be expressed in a kind of journalistic shorthand phrase or two or a word or two, something like busing or detente, where you can neatly and quickly distinguish the candidates. It tends to produce some controversy among the candidates, maybe between or among the candidates and the public. They tend to focus on that rather than those issues that involve complex details and relationships. That's the press. And given the constraints that you work with, I'm not voicing a criticism as much as I am suggesting that that is a problem. Because in contrast to that description of how you like to portray the issues in a campaign, the candidates, I think he correctly says, they prefer the diffuse issues. They like to talk in terms of broad policy proposals where the candidate's appeal differs mostly in style and in emphasis. For example, all of the candidates like to talk about the importance of revitalizing the economy or of maintaining a healthy growth in the economy. Phrases going way back to the 1960 campaign, like it's time or necessary to get the economy moving again. That's a very good example of the diffuse issue. And of course, the reason candidates, and I can speak not just from Mr. Patterson's perspective, but from my own very personal perspective as a candidate, because they like issues framed in those terms, because broad issues are really the issues that are of major concern to the voters. When you talk about the economy, when you talk about peace, when you talk about government efficiency, you're talking about problems that generally rank higher on any scale. If you look at any of the surveys that Yankelovich or Lou Harris or Gallup or any of the others do, these are the issues that rank highest on the scale of public concerns, as opposed to the more specific problems. You can gun control, maybe that's not a good issue to mention, because in the aftermath of the Lenin and the Halberstam slayings, I think that maybe has come to the forefront, as it should, of public consciousness in a very new and real way. But for the most part, you take a discrete issue of that kind, one where there is a specific solution, gun control, licensing. That is not really the kind of issue that is going to draw you that broad coalition of electoral support that you are trying to assemble in the course of a campaign. Well, I've talked rather longer than I should. Let me just close by suggesting that I didn't come merely to voice to criticism, but to maybe very quickly tick off two or three suggestions how I think the press can better serve this process of electing a president. I do think that front and center ought to be the idea of covering candidates who are proposing new ideas or who are discussing policy in a serious way as distinct from throwing all of their resources in with those candidates who are emphasizing only organization and straw polls and the like. Now, I will say this, that I think that from an issue point of view, the coverage improved vastly as we got into the general election. I think it was during the primary phase that the press got so involved with straw polls and dinner polls and who had the best organization in an early primary state that they got away from the issues. I think that tended that problem tended to diminish as the two conventions were held, the two candidates of the major parties were nominated, and the election went on. I don't know how you're going to do this, particularly, and I address myself now to those of you in television, but both television and the print media, it seems to me, ought to make more of an effort to report major policy addresses with really significant excerpts. In the first place, it would not only enlighten the public, but I think it would educate the candidates to the fact that there is a market for that kind of a statement, that instead of trying to simply indulge in this simplistic packaging that I referred to earlier, where you or your press secretary sit around noodling on how do I in 30 seconds reduce this idea to something that will get us in the news. Maybe the only way that we will ever address that problem is to take up the solution that was offered many years ago, at least 20 years ago, if not longer, and that is that you're going to have to give free blocks of time, significant blocks of time to candidates so that they can convey in this greater detail and greater depth what their real message is. And then finally, and this is not now directed to the media, because if I had any quarrel, I guess, with anybody on the debates, although I was a little disappointed when ABC thought that Midnight Cowboy was more important for the viewing public than a debate between two out of the three presidential candidates. But I do think that debates have got to become a fixed part of our political campaigns. And I would even go so far as to offer the view that I think participation ought to be a condition. It ought to be made a condition for receiving federal funds, that if candidates are not willing to engage through that format in that kind of discussion, I don't think that they should be eligible for the federal funding that was available in this last campaign. I think the process of evasion and extended negotiation over the debates that we endured in this past campaign was a real disservice to democracy. Well, Bruce, with my apologies to you for talking longer than I think I should, I still think I've left some time for some questions from the audience, and
yes,
I thank you very much.
Begin with the first question, Congressman. Early in the campaign, when David Garth became involved in your candidacy, there was some criticism that perhaps his description as a media wizard was going to do you more harm than good. As you look back on the suggestions that Mr. Garth made to you during the campaign, could you share some of those suggestions with us? And at any point, did you feel that you were being merchandised in the traditional way that candidates have been in the past?
Well, you know, the curious anomaly, I think, about the Garth participation in the campaign, and I'm aware of those who have suggested, as Curtis Gans did in a column a few weeks ago, that Anderson was Garthed and that this was what did us in. The anomaly of all this is that we had retained a media expert when actually ours was anything but a media campaign. We didn't have the money. We might have fallen into that trap, to be sure. But until we borrowed about $1,900,000 in the last month of the campaign from various lenders, not banks, but private individuals, we literally didn't have the money to go on the air. And you can't begin to compare the fairly modest amount of television advertising that we did in the last 10 days of the campaign with the $15 to $20 million at least, if not more, if you include independent expenditures, it would be much more than that, the at least $15 to $20 million that was spent by the other two campaigns. We were outspent 10 to 1. So I really don't think that our campaign was a media campaign, or that Mr. Garth played as large a role in the campaign as he's given credit for playing. He was not the issue man in the campaign, believe me. We had Professor Clifford Brown of Union College, who was really the man who rode herd on about 300 people whom we had assembled in various task forces to write the various sections of our platform, what we chose to call our program for the 1980s. And as far as the development, issue development was concerned, I think Clifford Brown, whose name is known to perhaps just a handful of people, was a far more significant element in the campaign than David Garth, simply because the money was not there to let Garth do his thing. And we hired him. I would also tell you this. The main reason, I think, why he was hired, and I don't think this is anything to apologize for, is that we thought it would give our campaign some credibility, that we had to have somebody with a name who could give the campaign some credibility for a certain amount of professionalism. Now, I didn't think the Doonesbury image, which might have been perfectly good while we were slogging through the early New England primaries, I didn't think the Doonesbury image was going to be good enough to get us through the whole campaign. I thought that in time our credibility would be challenged as a serious candidate unless we imported some degree of professional management into the campaign.
I'd like to ask about the future of independent campaigns for the presidency. Yours was much more prominent than any in the past. It was more successful, but not ultimately successful. You did raise more money.
Yeah.
You did get more media attention. You were credible. Will this encourage or discourage others in the future?
Oh, it's a tough question to answer because obviously, to some extent, history does not repeat itself. And I don't know whether the same conditions will be set up again in 1984. As you know, I came into the race on the 24th of April believing that there was this intense satisfaction on the part of the American people with both major party candidates. By that time, it was clear Reagan, even though the convention was still 2 or 3 months away, was going to be the nominee and that Carter was going to be nominated by the Democrats. And you recall all of those polls indicating 54% at least were dissatisfied. That was a strong motivating factor in my decision. Now, as time goes on, what offset that dissatisfaction was the no-win can't win syndrome. I wish I had a dollar for every person that's come up to me as I've traveled around the country in the last 6 weeks since the election who said, oh, I would have voted for you, but you know, I just figured you couldn't win. And I'm sorry after what I saw happen on election night that, you know, I didn't do what I really felt I wanted to do. But it was that feeling that gain currency, that we were a spoiler, that we could not win, that did us in. That plus, I think, our inability to get into the debates. When 1 week before the election, you had 100 million people watching the television screen, and it was framed in terms of dialogue between just two people, I mean, we were just out of the picture. And I had a sinking feeling as early as the first half of September when I saw the tactics of the Carter campaign team. I knew that they were going to resist our efforts to get into the debates and that we probably would never overcome that resistance. And it was downhill in the polls and everything else from that time forward.
Mr. Anderson, I'd like to take a question a step further. Excuse me. Nancy, to what degree you think the media, both print and electronic, are receptive to independent presidential candidates?
To what extent are they what?
Receptive to independent presidential candidates in Tucson. Not only in terms of media exposure, to say on the evening news and whatnot, but also in terms of the advertising time. Like, as you pointed out, it took you until the last 10 days of your campaign to raise enough money to get on there. And also, did that have anything to do with your decision to appear on the Today Show the week that you did during the Republican convention? And do you have any more contractual obligations to NBC?
No, I don't have any more obligations to them, and quite honestly, we undertook to do that simply because we felt that was the only way that we could probably get any coverage during the period of the Republican convention, and that the settings were sufficiently unusual, the garden of the Palace of the Tuileries and Egypt and Israel, that, you know, it would be eye-catching and get us some coverage. And we certainly were not in a position to buy any time that early in the campaign. We hadn't raised enough money to do that. So it was a simple factor that motivated that decision. That was to get some attention. But I generally am not complaining about the volume of coverage that my independent candidacy received, particularly in the general election part of the campaign, which I date from the period after the Democratic National Convention through the 4th of November. I think that the coverage was all right. I think, made it clear that threaded through the coverage all too often was the idea, in my opinion, that, you know, this was a hopeless, if not hapless, cause that simply couldn't go anywhere, and I wished that, you know, there hadn't been that tone given to some of the reporting that I observed. But from a standpoint of volume, I think the media generally was fair.
Two unrelated questions. First, are you satisfied with the format set up by the League of Women Voters for the debate, or would you like to see a more bloody-guts type approach to it?
The latter. I think the filtering the questions through four newsmen or newswomen, I don't think makes for the liveliest kind of exchange. I think the format was a little bit better, maybe, in the Reagan-Carter debate than it was in the one debate that I had with Reagan on the 21st of September. But I would like to see more of an old-fashioned debate format where you actually have a position taken, a rebuttal, a surrebuttal, and so on. And I think the more of that that you get into that hour or hour and a half, the more you would tend to hone the differences, sharpen the differences between the candidates or among the candidates, and contribute to a better public understanding of where they really stand. So I think the format could be improved.
Secondly, is there any future for John Anderson in the Republican Party?
Well, I'm not a member of the transition team, as you may have noted. Unlike Scoop Jackson, I have not been sitting in Washington waiting for my telephone to ring. I don't even leave a forwarding number when I travel around the country, as I've been doing. So I wouldn't imagine there's much future with this administration. But I've said this, I'm very comfortable in my present mode as an independent. I made that choice very deliberately and very consciously 7 months, 8 months ago, whatever the time period is now. And I think until I see more of this administration, till I, you know, we've had, what, about a dozen or less announcements of cabinet appointments so far, but we have yet to really see where this administration intends to take the country. Some suggestions that it may prove to be far more pragmatic than some of the campaign rhetoric would indicate. Until we see where the Carter or the Reagan administration is going, till we see whether the Democratic Party can get its act together, I'm satisfied to remain in an independent position where I can criticize, I think, both of them. or praise them if that occasion should arise. Oh, I could have obviously maybe skipped some of those Republican primaries and started down the road far earlier as an independent candidate when you are competing with the established party structures. Now, it's true, the parties aren't as strong as they used to be. I think it's probably correct to suggest that, you know, they've been going downhill ever since direct primaries were first adopted. And the laws were changed in that regard around the turn of the century. But they still have the infrastructure that an independent candidate does not have. And therefore, I think his effort, if it's going to be properly funded, if it's going to be properly organized, is going to take far more time than the 6 months and 1 week that elapsed between my declaration as an independent and the election. So I think I would have started much earlier. I'm sure we made a lot of other mistakes during the course of the campaign that I would not want to repeat again. But that's really the principle thing that bothered me, is that we were just always literally racing the clock.
Considering that, and considering all the people who later told you they would have liked to have voted for you, have you thought about organizing an independent party? Are you considering that?
Well, I've thought about it, sure, but I think I go back to the answer I made to a previous question. It seems to me that until we have a better idea of what the Reagan program really is, suddenly, you know, we've begun to hear just in the last week or so about the intention of this administration to declare an economic emergency. I certainly heard nothing about that over the long months of the primary campaign or the general election. I rather had the impression that, you know, this was going to be a laid-back administration where if we only adopted a very calm, laissez-faire approach to the problems of the economy, things would pretty well take care of themselves. Get the government off the backs of business and the energy industry particularly, and the energy would flow, the oil would flow. Now, you know, we're being told by some of the presidential advisors, apparently, that we've got to contemplate the declaration of an economic emergency without many details as yet as to what that involves. Is there going to be some request for extraordinary emergency powers by the president? Is he going to seek to repeal the present provisions of the Budget Control and Anti-Impoundment Act that were passed in answer to Nixon's effort to take over the appropriations function of the Congress? I don't know. So until I know where the administration is going, and I repeat, until I see how effective the Democratic Party is in performing the role of a credible opposition, I think it would be premature to talk about a third party or an independent party or anything else. And in the spirit of John Paul Jones, I shall not fire until I see the whites of their eyes.
Do you think, though, that it would be, if you were to make another bid or to advise someone else making another independent bid, they would be better off with the party structure?
Yes, I do. I think it's awfully difficult. Well, there, you know, there are a lot of reasons simply under the federal campaign law. You can get contributions up to $20,000 to a political party. Whereas, of course, the $1,000 limitation applies to an independent candidate.
Considering what you just said, isn't it almost impossible for an independent to make it in terms of the amount of money necessary to buy the time that Dave Gard would have bought for you and the commercials he would have made for you
Well, you can't do that because the law provides that the candidate cannot contribute more than $50,000 of his own money. So even if you had the $1 trillion, that wouldn't help. Well, as I said in answer to the last question, I think that, you know, there are huge advantages that do accrue to a party as opposed to an independent candidacy. Yeah.
Two of the most spirited debates you were involved in early on in the campaign during the Republican primary.
One of them right here in this hotel.
Right. Where you appeared to be the victim of a gang-up.
Mm-hmm.
You were also involved in the classic Nashua debate when you appeared to be part of the team that was ganging up on George Bush. I'm wondering if you could share light.
I was injured on one occasion and innocent on the other, of course.
Can you describe your involvement in each of those two debates and how they evolved?
Well, you know, I think clearly the debate that was held on the 15th of March here in Chicago in this hotel did represent a conscious effort on the part of several candidates on the platform that night to use that format in the last half hour to question my credentials. There isn't any question, I think, that can be established that there was some collaboration between Mr. Crane and at least one, if not two, other candidates in the race between Don Totten, Phil Crane, possibly others, and that they elected deliberately to try to muddy us up on that issue of party regularity and party loyalty. But despite that experience, I'm not willing to recant in my belief that that kind of interchange, maybe not. The problem with that format was, of course, that you had four people participating, and I think that does make it a little bit awkward. I'm thinking that a debate with only two or three people would probably work much better. But on the second debate, the one in Nashua, I think in retrospect that Mr. Sears rather cleverly orchestrated that event. I have learned that, you know, from talking to some people in the Reagan campaign.
In what way?
And, well, that he did invite all of the other candidates to come, knowing that, you know, it was likely that this kind of a standoff would occur and that it would put Mr. Reagan in the position of being the soul of magnanimity by being willing to let everybody up on the stage to participate. And they had a pretty good idea that the Bush camp would take the position that they did, that it could only be a two-man debate. So, you know, I think we were props to some extent for that, but I came in response to a telephoned invitation from Mr. Sears in good faith, and I don't think that I have anything to apologize for, even though it did prove to be very costly, I think, to Mr. Bush, because without suggesting that it was the sole reason for Reagan's, what was it, 51-26%, I think, victory, something like that, 47-26% win in New Hampshire. I think it certainly added to his margin. I mean, it made him the big winner on the 26th of February. So I think that we did assist the Reagan campaign by attending that night and by going out on the stage and doing what we did, but somehow I don't feel very repentant about my part in that incident.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I have just a couple of other announcements. Our next Academy luncheon will be on...
...to concentrate, you know, on the military aspect of diplomacy. It was Clemenceau, you know, who said that war is too important a matter to be left to the generals. I think foreign policy is too important a question to be left, matter to be left to the generals. And it is that aspect, I think, of his choice that gives me some pause. Again, in the spirit of fairness for which I hope I'm known, I suppose I'm willing to reserve final judgment until I hear what Mr. Haig has to say.
What's wrong with a military man in a foreign policy post?
You had George C. Marshall, who was a military man, and of course is credited, and quite properly, with some great accomplishments. I think, however, that what I said in answering your question earlier was that you have Mr. Haig conjoined, if that's the right word, with a president who seems to take, you know, a very, very militaristic view of the world. He seems to have imbibed a little bit of Richard Nixon's philosophy in his latest book, you know, that World War III has already begun. And I guess it's that fact that gives me some concern.
So you feel Senator Cranston and the others are justified in promising a rather lengthy and exhaustive hearing?
What is the confirmation process for? You know, if it is not to satisfy, I think, not just the members of the Senate, but the nation about a man's qualifications. I don't think a president, should just have anybody in those jobs. If so, why insert a provision?
Are there any other appointments? What about the makeup of the cabinet itself?
Are there any other appointments, I was wondering, that you feel, deserve particular scrutiny?
Well, I know so little about some of these people. I never heard of Ray Donovan before. He's a contractor in a post, dealing with labor. Maybe he has splendid qualifications. What they are, I don't know.
David Stockman, you know well. He used to be on your staff. How would you characterize him?
Oh, I think just as one of his colleagues in the House, Richard and Barbara Connable, was quoted in one of the news magazines a week ago saying, I think he's a rather rigid, doctrinaire young man. I think he's quite ideological in his approach. I don't think he is the pragmatist that some people think he is. I think he's quite an ideologue.
Is he the man to watch? Is he the one that's going to upset?
I don't think that he would have. I don't think an OMB director has that kind of power. I think a Secretary of Treasury, and I think a chairman of a Federal Reserve Board, I think a chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, all of those people are going to have the president's ear also on matters of economic policy. So I wouldn't imagine that an OMB director is going to, ride roughshod over policy recommendations that will come from other people in the administration.
Congressman, what about the makeup of the cabinet?
I look at an OMB director as pretty much a technocrat, really. You know, he's a technician. He's working with numbers, with figures.
Well, here's an ideologue who's a technician. What's that going to lead to?
I think it will make it incumbent on Mr. Reagan, I think, to show some balance, when it comes to accepting economic advice.
What about the composition, Congressman, of the picks? They seem...
I told Mr. Stockman that once when he worked for me. I said, you are a technocrat, young man.
He worked for you
On the conference. I said you are a technocrat. That's how
you
I would describe it.
He was getting a little out of line, you felt?
Well, I just felt that there's a human side to problems that government deals with. You know, people who are unemployed are not just statistics. And when you look at unemployment compensation and the money that is being spent for income transfer programs, which he seems very disposed to cut, you're dealing with human beings. You're not just dealing with numbers. That's what I mean. That you can be, too much the technocrat.
Some people have said the cabinet looks very managerial and not ideological.
Yeah, I think it fits in with
you. You seem to feel that there's an ideological look.
Oh, I think there's some ideological cast to it. You know.
Do you see any balance there?
What about the absence of women and artists today?
I think it's pretty much, you know, it's a conservative, very conservative group.
Is it what you would expect it, or any surprise? Of course, you don't know these people, but
I'm not surprised. No.
You don't feel that.
Take Mr. Watt. I mean, the fellow who's going to be Secretary of the Interior. I mean, whose strongest and most ardent advocate was Joe Coors. You know, I don't think Mr. Coors has ever been accused of being, you know, friendly to environmental causes.
You think that's a mistake, that particular one, then?
Yes. I from what I read of his background, again, I want to bend over backwards to be very fair, be very open-minded, but I'm disquieted by the implications.
Because of what do you fear there?
Well, I've looked at some of the lawsuits that have been filed by this legal defense fund, or whatever they call this outfit that that he heads. And it seems to me that you put that together with what seems to be Mr. Reagan's belief that, you know, all you have to do is drop regulations and the economy is going to take off, that, you know, I think those of us who still think that there's reason to protect the environment and to be concerned about it have got our work cut out for us.
I think there's a message to environmentalists with this appointment.
Yes, I think so. And it's not one that I think is you know, very cheerful.
Where are you going to make your home, by the way? In Washington?
I will be in Washington for the time being. I may be back in Rockford after the first of the year. I haven't decided. I have two children, you know, school-age kids, one in elementary school and one in high school. So I've got to decide whether I should keep them. They're going to school in Rockford right now.
Congressman, one more question on the cabinet, if I may. There's been some criticism about the composition in terms of the lack of women and minorities.
Yeah,
so
I would
that
hope. I would,
you,
yes, I would hope that. Of course, he hasn't completed his selections. He may yet pick a woman. I think there should be.
Mm-hmm.
I would be disappointed if there were none.
Mm-hmm. But do you think to date the absence of one to date, especially in some of these major positions, is a sign, a negative sign? For women and minorities in the country?
Well, I mean, I think in view of Mr. Reagan's well-known views on the Equal Rights Amendment and so on, it's not, should not be the occasion for any great surprise. But, you know, obviously those women's causes are not going to be pushed very vigorously, I think, by Mr. Reagan.
Well, weren't you a little surprised when he came up with Hague and you know, and all of a sudden he's inviting a fight even before he's in there, or did you expect that from...
Well, I sort of go along with the logic that Byrd almost did it, you know, for Haig when he somewhat prematurely indicated that he would be ready to mount...
Byrd solidified it then.
Yeah, I think he kind of threw down the gauntlet.
Wasn't anything else you could do then?
I think that's probably true. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Congressman.
Well, good to be in.